Okay, let's pick up where we left off in Exodus chapter 3. It says, Now Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness, and it came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of a bush, and he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, yet the bush was not consumed. So Moses said, I must turn aside and now and see this marvelous sight, why this bush is not burned up. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. And he said, Do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, and the place at which you are standing is holy ground. He said also, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. Then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the afflictions of my people who are in Egypt, and I have given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters, for I am aware of their sufferings. So I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians and to bring them from up from the land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanite and the Hittite and the Amorite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite. And now, behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppression which these Egyptians are oppressing them. Therefore, come now, and I will send you to Pharaoh, so that you may bring my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt. Okay, before we go any further, it just says that Moses now is down around Mount Horeb, and he's pasturing his father-in-law's sheep. And there he sees this burning bush. And it really catches his eye because the bush is burning, but it's not being consumed, by the fire. And it catches his attention. Of course, he goes up to the bush, to investigate it, and that's when he meets God. And I think it's kind of significant, when it talks about this burning bush, because if you read in Corinthians, 2 Corinthians in the chapter 4, it's kind of interesting because the bush is burning, but it's not being consumed. In a way, the bush almost symbolizes a believer. And the fire, of course, symbolizes God. And the reason I say that is, if you read what Paul had written in Corinthians, he says this, But we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the surpassing greatness of the power may be of God and not of ourselves. Now listen to this. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not despairing, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed, always carrying about in the body the dying of Jesus, that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our body. For we who live are constantly being delivered over to death for Jesus' sake, but the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our mortal flesh. So death works in us, but life in you. And you got kind of a symbolism there that I think it's kind of significant. A bush that is being consumed, but it's not burned up. Okay, in a way, this is what happens when God, comes into our life. It's that we do have, a life that can very well be perplexing or be being persecuted or going through trials or difficulties, setbacks, disappointments, and these type of things. But we're never crushed. We're never beyond the point of where we are destroyed or forsaken. It's just simply that God is working in us. And in doing that, we do become more and more what Jesus referred to as being the light of the world, where we become a light for other people. I didn't want to get off on a tangent there, but I think it's kind of significant that he sees this burning bush, okay, and he goes over to investigate, and then God calls him. And I think it's significant because he calls him by name. Yeah, I think that is kind of significant because it should speak to all of us here. First of all, let's back up for a minute because he says here in that verse 2, it says, And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of the bush, and he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, yet the bush was not consumed. It says, The angel of the Lord appeared to him. And I've mentioned this many times throughout the years, but the angel, whatever you find in that context, the angel of the Lord, it always refers to the title of the pre-incarnate Christ. This is not just any ordinary angel. It's the angel of the Lord. It's not that Christ is an angel by any means. It's just simply that an angel means messenger. And here Christ, when he came down, he was the Word of God. He was the Word made flesh. Well, here he's referred to as the angel of the Lord because in a sense, his pre-incarnate state, he was the messenger of God still. That's what it meant, the angel of the Lord. So it was Christ burning actually in the bush there. And then it says here that Moses turned aside to investigate it. And then it says here, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, "Moses, Moses," and he said, "Here I am." I do think that's kind of significant. I think in a way it's kind of, touching, simply because you see something very personal there, that Moses is being called by God by name. He's being, that's why God deals with each and every one of us, is individually and by name, okay? We're not, a nameless face in a massive sea of nobodies. We're not just a number. I mean, to God, we are an individual. We are a person, and he calls us by name. I mean, to me, there's something about that that shows, that God is a very personal God. Okay, and I don't know if you've ever had the experience. I know I've had it in my life, and it's not very often I've had it, and very, very rarely I've had it. But on occasion, I almost feel like there's been a circumstance or situations where I feel like God has touched me. Have you ever felt that way, where you felt like God's touched you? I mean, when you feel that, you feel almost like there's such a personalness in it. And that touch, that the way he will communicate something to you, it really shows. I mean, to me, it's almost overwhelming emotionally, just simply because you feel like, hey, I'm such a nobody, such an insignificant nothing, and the God of the universe touches me and calls me by name and, assures me that he has everything in control. I mean, that to me, is just an experience that you just cannot put into words, because it's so personal. And it's such a reassuring experience to know that, hey, in spite of myself, God is very, very personal, and he's made him, and he looks at me as being, an individual. I'm not just a number. Try dealing with the government and you see what a number is, and you know how impersonal, you are, and how meaningless you are, right? When you're dealing with the DMV or the IRS or whatever, you know that you are nothing. When you're dealing with the God of the universe and he really communicates this to you, that you are, a person. I mean, that to me is very significant. So he called Moses by name. And he calls each one of us by name, And he says, "Do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground." Now, why would he say remove your sandals? Because the place is holy ground. Why would he say that?
The dirt of the world on it?
Good. In a sense, it's a spiritual significance to it. Because, in other words, we have to remove from our presence, from ourselves, that which gives us contact with the world before we come into the presence of God. I think it's kind of significant that, remember when Jesus said, the night before he died, he washed his disciples' feet. He was going around washing each one of their feet, and then Peter didn't want to have anything to do with it. And then Jesus said, "Hey, listen, if I don't wash your feet, you're not going to have anything to do with me." And Peter said, "Hey, wash my whole body." And Jesus said, "No, once you've bathed, you only need to wash your feet." In other words, there was a very common custom in Jesus' day where a person, if they took a bath, they showered or whatever, and they got their clothes on, they would... let's just say they just walk down the road to their neighbor's house. Very often, if they go into their neighbor's house, their neighbor would, take off their sandals, or they would have their servants take off their sandals, and they would wash their feet there. Why? Because back then, they didn't have any pavement. They didn't have any sidewalks. They didn't have any asphalt. Instead, people had sandals, and the roads were very dusty and dirty. And when you'd get from one place to another, very often your feet would you'd have all this dust and this dirt clinging to your feet. And it would be uncomfortable. Okay, you would feel uncomfortable. So very often when you go into a house, you'd get your feet washed. Well, in a sense, Jesus said this is very important. This is what we're doing here, in a sense, spiritually. We're sitting around and we're washing each other's feet, not literally, but spiritually. We are removing the dirt or the dust of the world from our feet, because it's almost as though, even though we don't, let's say we haven't sinned today, let's just say, for example, okay, if you're not aware of having sinned or offended God today in any way, you still have had contact with the world all day long. In a sense, that's draining. Spiritually, that's draining. I mean, I can guarantee it, especially people who sit at a job for 8 hours a day and have to do something that's very mundane and very, it's all full of drudgery and whatever. There's a lot that can go into that. It's just simply that contact with the world drains you spiritually, especially if you go into places that are very worldly. Okay, it can drain you spiritually. And they don't have to be sinful places. You spend 5 hours in the mall, you need your feet washed spiritually. Why? Because there in the mall is a concentration of what? The pride of life and the lust of the eyes and the lust of the flesh. It's all there. Okay? You may not have sinned, but it's simply your contact with the world, in a sense, needs to be dealt with, okay, when we come into the presence of God. That's why he says to Moses, remove your sandals, because you're standing on holy ground. And we have to recognize that, that we come into the presence of God, we've got to leave the contact of the world behind us, the things of the world behind us, okay? We can't come into the presence of God thinking, oh, gee, you know, how are my stocks doing? How are my bonds doing? Or, you know, what's? I wonder if I'm going to get my bonus and all this. That's what? That's bringing in the dust of the world, isn't it? You got to put all that aside and, you know, come into God's presence and remove those sandals and give them your undivided attention, okay? Because the world is contaminating. Even if you haven't sinned, it's still contaminating and it's draining spiritually. So that's what we told them.
All day long, we deal with the world all
right.
around us.
Right.
Even driving over here.
Right. Oh, that's a good example. It is.
I realize by the time I get here, I'm like, argh.
Right, isn't it?
You gotta just, yeah, it's all around you.
Exactly.
You gotta tear yourself away. Yeah.
Right. It's a good. It's a very good example. You know.
It's very hard.
No, I know I'm getting off on a tangent here, but you know, I thought it was very significant that when God divided up the land for his tribes. Okay, he didn't give the tribe of Levi any land. He told them that they were to dwell in cities, okay? And I thought that's very significant because they were the Levi tribe, they were the priestly tribe, and they were to dwell in the cities for the very specific purpose of influencing the people in the cities. And one of the reasons why I think that God had the Levi tribe dwell in cities is because when you get in a city situation, you have people that are really, you know, crammed together. And what happens when you have, you know, a whole bunch of sinners put together in one spot, they seem to promote more and more sin. Okay, I know we're getting off on a tangent here, but this is the same spiritual principle here, that when you're living in the world, okay, we're talking about we're driving from A to B. We're living in a congested world. It's becoming more and more congested. And the more congested it comes, the more irritating it comes, the more aggravating it comes, and the more you see the world that's there, it's pressing in on you. And that, and believe it or not, that's when you need more than ever to get along with God, to get some solitude with him, okay, to seek him out. You see what I'm saying? Because the world is so encroaching upon us that it becomes a spiritual drain. See what I'm saying? That's why we're going back to this idea of removing your shoes. I mean, and the more you are in a crowded environment, the more defiled you're going to become because you're around more and more defiled people. And verse 5, then he says, do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you're standing is holy ground. And he said also, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Now look at the way he worded this. If you remember in the Gospels, when they were talking about the resurrection, you know, when Jesus was dealing with the Sadducees who didn't believe in the resurrection, Jesus said, hey, haven't you heard where it was written, where it says that God said, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob? Showing that there is a resurrection. In other words, this, if it says, now Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are dead. So the way it really should read here is, I was the God of Abraham. I was the God of Isaac. I was the God of Jacob. That's the way it should read. But since they're not dead, they're still alive, even though their bodies have been dead for centuries. Their spirits are still very much alive. So God says, I am the God of Abraham. I am the God of Isaac. I am the God of Jacob. You see the difference? See the distinction? You know, and Jesus made this point to them, showing that, yeah, you know, when you die, hey, you know, you're still very much alive or very conscious after death. So, and then he says here that Moses was afraid to look at God. In verse 7, he says, and the Lord says, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and I have given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters, for I am aware of their suffering. Now, that to me is very personal. It's very reassuring, especially when you're going through deep water, especially when you're going through troubles and difficulties and trials, when you feel like, where is God in this? Where is God in this? You know, why isn't he answering my prayers? I mean, he's as silent as a tomb. I feel like I've just beat my knuckles to the raw on his door, and nobody seems to answer. But he says, hey, I've seen it all. I'm aware of it all. I know their suffering. I know their pain. I know their heartbreak. And verse 8, he says, so I have come down to deliver them. I like that because it says, I've come down. Okay? In other words, he was in heaven, but he came down to deliver his people. It's the same thing that Jesus did. It's a prefiguring of what Jesus would do for us. He came down from heaven to deliver us. Right? That's how personal he is. I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians and to bring them up from the land, a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to a place of the Canaanite and the Hittite and the Amorite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite. You know, it says a land flowing with milk and honey. So, I mean, some Sunday school teacher asked him, what did he mean by flowing with milk and honey? What do you think that means? And some girl said, well, that must mean it's really sticky. Well, that's not what it means. What it means is that, you know, if land flowing with milk and honey just simply means it's a land that's very, very fertile. You know, it's very, very productive. I mean, there's nothing but the best of the land and the best of the produce. Everything is there. And he says that it's the land of the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Jebusite and the Canaanite. And God's going to take this land away from them and give it to his people. And, of course, the worldly mind will look at this and say, well, that isn't fair of God to do that, to take these people's land away from them and give it to somebody else. But remember this, and I wish every person in the world could really get this burned into their mind, especially people who are forever claiming to be victims or forever claiming to be minorities or forever claiming to be superior. God is no respecter of persons. And what he's told his people is this, hey, I'm going to give you this land, and you get into land. If you start acting like the Canaanites did, you start acting like them, and out you go. And we know from history that's exactly what happened. God threw out the Canaanite and the Amorite and the Perizzite and the Jebusite because they were wicked. Their wickedness had begun to overflow, and God says, okay, you're out of here. So he had them destroyed. And he put his people in their place. But then when his people started acting like them, he says, you're out of here too. You know, God's no respecter of persons. So then he says in verse 9, he says, now behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians are oppressing them. Therefore, come now, and I will send you to Pharaoh so that you may bring my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? And he said, certainly I will be with you, and this shall be a sign to you, that is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain. Now, this is interesting, is that now Moses is a changed man because he says, oh man, Lord, who am I? I mean, you don't want to send me. I mean, send somebody else. I mean, I'm nobody, you know. But here again, God brought him to the place where he wants him to be. In other words, when he sees his inadequacy, he sees, hey, I'm not the man for the job. I mean, you know, really, Lord, get somebody else because I'm just not the one. Well, that's the kind of person that God wants. Okay? Is a person who's not going to be self-sufficient or self-reliant, who's not going to look upon themselves with their own energy, their own strength, their own talent, their own ability, but they're going to say, hey, man, I can't do it. Well, that's where God very often wants us to get us to that place where Moses now is. 40 years before this, he wasn't there. He figured, well, you know, politically, I could do this. But now he says, hey, man, you got the wrong guy. Well, no, God got the right guy. He just got him. He's just a changed man at this particular time in his life. Okay. But look at the way God says. He says, this will be the sign to you. The sign is, you're going to come back here with all the nation of Israel with you, and you're going to worship at this mountain. You know, you ever heard this saying that the proof is in the pudding, right? Well, God said, basically, this is the sign that God says he's going to give you. In other words, he's not giving them a sign up front. He's saying, hey, you'll know when they're all over here that I've used you to bring them here, and they'll be worshiping at this mountain. The proof is in the pudding. You'll see. That's basically what he's telling them. And verse 13, it says, then Moses said to God, behold, I am going to the sons of Israel, and I shall say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. Now they may say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, I am has sent you. Now, isn't that amazing? What does that mean? I am that I am, or I am who I am.
He's always been.
State of being.
In what sense?
I've never been created.
There's no past or future. It's just
I always am.
Yeah, that's all included there, but also it's like, hey, I am that I am, or I am who I am, meaning I am totally self-sufficient. Mm-hmm. I need no one. I am totally self-sufficient. I mean, you know, can any created creature say that?
Nope.
any, you know, not the highest angel in heaven or hell can say that. You know, not the most powerful man on earth can say that. I am who I am. And remember when the Jews were, you know, lambasted in Christ, and Christ said to them, hey, Abraham, rejoice to see my day. Remember when he said that? And these people said, hey, wait a minute, you're not even 50 years old. What do you mean, Abraham, rejoice to see your day? He says, hey, before Abraham, I am. When he said that, they had a fit. They were going to stone him to death. And they said, hey, what good deed are you going to kill me for? And he says, hey, not for any good deed you've done, but you have made yourself equal with God. You've called yourself the Son of God. You've made yourself equal with God. There was no doubt in their mind what he was saying. They were ready to stone him to death for it. But he said, before Abraham, I am. I mean, that shows his eternal state right there. But it shows his all sufficiency, right? God does not need anyone or anything. I am who I am. I am that I am.
It also showed that it never changed.
Right, exactly. Good, good point. Like, yeah. Mm-hmm. Not just that he's eternal, but he's the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. I am that I am. I am who I am. That's what, I mean, it seems weird. Go tell him, I am sent you. You know? I mean, try to say that to somebody today. I mean, it doesn't seem to make any sense at all, but it makes perfect sense applied to God. Mm-hmm. Okay? And then he says, verse 15, it says, God furthermore said to Moses, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever. This is my memorial name to all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I am indeed concerned about you and what has been done to you in Egypt. So I said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt, of the land of the Canaanite and the Hittite and the Amorite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite, to a land flowing with milk and honey. And they will pay heed to what you say, and you, with the elders of Israel, will come to the king of Egypt, and you will say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. So now, please let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness, so that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. But I know that the king of Egypt will not permit you to go, except under compulsion. So I will stretch out my hand, and I will strike Egypt with all the miracles which I shall do in the midst of it. And after that, he will let you go. And I will grant this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and it shall be that when you go, you will not go out empty-handed, but every woman shall ask of her neighbor and the woman who lives in her house articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing, and you will put them on your sons and daughters, and thus you will plunder the Egyptians. Okay, just winding this down tonight, I think it's kind of significant that he says, okay, when you go there, speak to the elders, tell them that I am sent you, and then, you know, you will go to Pharaoh and tell him, hey, God appeared to us, and he wants us to go a three-day journey out into the wilderness to sacrifice to him. And God knew that he was just baiting Pharaoh. He was just going to say, okay, I'm going to tell Pharaoh what I want. Pharaoh's going to just say, laugh at you, and he's going to make things harder for you. Hey, but it's all going to work out because I'm going to just deal with him in my own good way, in my own good time. But I think it's kind of interesting here, he says that you will eventually come out, and when you come out, you're not going to come out empty-handed. You're going to come out with all kinds of silver and gold and articles of wealth and everything else. And again, the natural mind may look at this and say, well, that doesn't seem right. Why would God do that? Take away what other people have and give it to these people. But what's the justice in it?
Slaves.
Exactly. For years and years and years, for over 400 years, they have been oppressed and then they have been enslaved. And God is saying, hey, you're not going to get away with that. You are not going to get away for that for 1 minute, because you are going to end up paying my people for all their labor. So they ended up getting paid. And that's the same, unfortunately, same thing that happened in this country, in a sense that we had that cursed slavery in this country. What happened? People built up their plantations, they built up all their wealth, and they built up all this on the backs of other human beings. But what happened? Hey, the armies of Sherman marched through, you know, the South and destroyed virtually everything. You know, everything of wealth that was just confiscated or stolen or destroyed or burned down. Hey, we cannot build our home, our house, our establishment on, you know, the exploitation of other people, on, you know, and get away with it. I mean, we just can't do it. God will eventually catch up with us, and God in turn, you see the justice of God, how he deals with this. He turns around, his people walk out of there wealthy, and the Egyptians are poverty stricken, and their country is ruined because they tried to exploit these people and make themselves rich off of the toil of other people. Anybody have anything want to add or share?
No.